Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Allergy Talk, a roundup of the latest in the field of allergy and immunology by the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. For today's episode, we'll be reviewing articles from Allergy Watch, a bi-monthly publication which provides research summaries to college members from the major journals in allergy and immunology. And you can also earn CME credit by listening to this podcast. For information about CME credit, head over to education.acai.org/allergytalk. And also, make sure you check out the Doc Matter community, where we can continue the discussion about these articles. Well, hello again. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University, an assistant editor of Allergy Watch. And today, once again, I'm joined by the editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch, Dr. Stan Fineman.
Thanks, Jerry, and it's great to be here. I'm a past president of the college and, as Jerry said, editor-in-chief of Allergy Watch. I'm also an adjunct faculty at Emory.
And for the third chair, once again, we're joined by Dr. Sarah Spreet, a staff allergist immunologist at AT Augusta Military Medical Center, an associate program director for the AI Fellowship at Walter Reed, an associate professor of pediatrics at Uniformed Services University, and an assistant editor of Allergy Watch. Sarah, welcome back to Allergy Talk.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Okay, we have three more very interesting articles. And Sarah, you're going to start us off. Looks like we're going to have expanding more options for our allergic children. So tell us about it.
Here's hoping. If you're like me, you take care of a lot of kids with allergic rhinitis and conjunctivitis. And so these authors in Europe brought us a pivotal phase 3 trial entitled the Sub-Q Tree Sublingual Immunotherapy Tablet is Effective and Well-Tolerated in Children. And this was published in Allergy in September 2024 and published by GAPA and colleagues across multiple centers in Europe. So this phase 3 trial studied the safety and efficacy of a slit tablet containing standardized BET, so a birch allergen, in 12 sub-Q units. Over 950 children ages 5 to 17 years with moderate to severe allergic rhinitis or allergic conjunctivitis were randomized 1-to-1 to treatment with daily slit tablet or placebo for up to 52 weeks. The primary endpoint was average total combined score, which is determined by their daily symptom score and their daily medication score. And that was recorded via electronic diaries during the study trial. These scores were recorded both during birch pollen season and the entire tree pollen season. And the researchers analyzed the scores for the entire tree pollen season as a secondary endpoint. And so what they found was a significant reduction in the total combined score for the treatment group with 22% relative reduction compared to the placebo during birch pollen season, their primary endpoint. They also found a 19% relative reduction in total combined scoring for the entire tree pollen season. And the tablet was well tolerated with only mild local site reactions reported. And the safety profile was similar for those children with and without asthma. So the main takeaway from this was if this does become available to our patients here in the United States, it would certainly offer us a safe and convenient option for the young patients with allergic rhinitis or allergic conjunctivitis due to birch pollen homologous groups of trees, and it would improve quality of life and potentially prevent disease progression. So very, very exciting and would be great to add to our armamentum for these pediatric allergic rhinoconjunctivitis patients if it becomes available.
I agree with you. I think it's a lot easier for children to take something sublingually than it is to get a shot. There's a big pushback for the shots, obviously. But you said that this was a pivotal trial in Europe, and it looked like the total symptom score improvement was like a 21.9%. So would that, I'm not sure what the confidence interval was, but would that, you think it would be approved by the FDA here for our kids in the United States?
That's a great question. Jerry, you have any insight on that?
Oh, goodness gracious. I'm not sure of the threshold, but Certainly, there is a gap in this population. So I would imagine that information is going to be useful when they're going to seek FDA approval in the United States. I guess my question is, if I think back to my population, I don't see a lot of patients that are monosensitized to birch. So I guess I always struggle with that. I'm curious, how often have you all given sublingual to polysensitized patients, and what's been your experience? I can tell you that, and this is biased, so I haven't tried, but the patients that have been monosensitized, for example, I remember someone who was on like 5 drugs during the summer, and she had Timothy grass allergy. I put her on sublingual Timothy grass. She was off zero, like she was on nothing. Like it was amazing. But I don't have very many patients like that. Most patients are off like 5 or 6 pollens. So what's y'all been experienced with polysensitized patients? Have you tried it before?
So I've used it off label, and that's the thing we have to qualify, because sublingual immunotherapy, except for the tablets, is really off label here in the United States. And I remember a debate really in the college meeting a few years ago. And what came out of the debate was the fact that we were basically presenting some of the data that we developed for some of our sublingual patients that were using polysensitized sublingual immunotherapy. And the problem is there are other studies that show that it didn't work when they were polysensitized and there were multiple allergens in the sublingual solution. So the problem is there's really no good data. There's no good study like this showing a very good positive effect on your total symptom scores with multi-sensitized sublingual treatment. So that, I think, is our problem. And I guess we're using it off-label, and that's a challenge in and of itself, too.
But I think if we can find the younger patient who it's only oak or birch, which, granted, to your point, it's going to be case by case, right? Which is typically my slit tablet patients are the exception. They're not the majority that I take care of. But if we can prevent that progression to polysensitization, and I actually find the 5 or 6-year-old who it's only oak and birch pollen allergy right now, that's probably the optimal patient to start this in based on the reduction in symptom scores. But I also recognize that that's far and few in between patients that I'm going to find who are monosensitized to that birch homologous tree-induced allergic rhinitis conjunctivitis.
And maybe I'm being a little close-minded or restrictive. So, I mean, that's where the email's for. So anyone listening, if anyone has experience with something like grass pollen, when you have both tree and grass pollen allergy, and you want to tell me your experience, I'm just so curious. I think that certainly we are huge believers in desensitization. Like, why not get to the root cause rather than just using medicine to control the symptoms? If we desensitize and try to get them off medicine, I mean, the patient wants that. We want that. It's just, I guess we have this idealism that we got to hit everything by doing multi-allergen. But if a single allergen immunotherapy gets them the majority of the way there, I don't want to withhold that or present it in a negative light. So anyways, that's just my curiosity. I'm just, again, maybe overly skeptical, but I'm willing to learn. I'm willing to consider it for sure, especially if it's going to avoid a kid getting an injection.
And I think it's shared decision-making, like so much of our practice, right? So I have started a few polysensitized patients on the single slit tablet to grass or to dust mite. But I certainly present the pros and the cons of that approach and come to that shared decision-making with the patient.
All right. Yeah, great point. Let's go to the next article. So Stan, I get whiplash hearing about cat and dog and early and late and that sort of thing. So I don't think we'll ever have like the definitive study, but you have a very interesting article that adds to the conversation. So what did this study teach us?
Okay, so this was a study that was published in our Annals of Allergy in November of 2024. It was entitled Persistent Cat Ownership and Asthma in a Longitudinal Study in Puerto Rican Youth. And it was basically a study where they were trying to see the effect of having cat or dog exposure during their childhood, how it impacted their childhood asthma. It was a prospective study. It was really done in two different prospective studies. One was the prospective study of Puerto Rican youth and asthma, or called the PROPA study, which the participants were visited during their first visit between ages of 6 and 14. One was pro-goal and one was pro-PA. Anyway, the bottom line was the second one was the epigenetic variation in childhood asthma. And that was, they looked at those kids in February of 14 through 17. The other one was in 2009 through 2010. So they were able to look at the children when they were younger and when they were older, just by a few years. So the first one, the baseline visit ages were 6 to 14. The second visit, the ages were 9 to 20. And then they threw a questionnaire. They asked, were they exposed to a cat or a dog during the whole time that they were either an infant, even in utero, and did that impact the existence of their asthma? And interestingly, the children who had a cat, both during the early life as well as when they were older in school, had a 68% odds lower, or lower odds of having asthma compared to children who never owned a cat at all. And having a cat in one stage only was not associated with asthma, and neither was dog ownership, which I thought was a little bit surprising. So the only statistical association found between dog ownership and school-aged children was having a positive IgE test to dog allergen. And so that's what they found there. But the bottom line was that this statistically, they, through their various analysis, found that the 68% lower odds of having asthma in school age when the children were continually exposed to a cat, I thought was pretty unique. Now, when you look at some of the e-study data, the electronic tables, and you look at see the amount of allergen in the sensitivity to the dog was much higher than in the cat. It was almost double. So the specific IgE to dog was in the early life, 22% had it in one and 16% had it in the other. And for the cat was 11.8% in the early life and school age and only 6.4 who had never been exposed before at all. So they were trying to use a statistical analysis to figure out whether this was significant, and they were able to find the significance. Now, does that mean I'm going to tell my patients to go get a cat? No, I'm not, because I don't think that's really a helpful thing. Yeah. But I'm not even going to tell them to get a dog, even though there have been other studies that showed that having a dog or having two dogs seemed to reduce the risk of asthma when you were a child. So this is just another study trying to prove the hygiene hypothesis. And anyway, it's a little complicated when you look at the statistics, but I thought it was interesting because I'm a big fan of the hygiene hypothesis, and I always like to look at studies like that.
Yeah, I'll just say that I appreciate that they controlled for some of the socioeconomic variables in this, including household income, even body habitus and unhealthy diet, which I think are important factors to control for when you're doing a multivariable analysis. I would have liked for them to also maybe assess the dust mite sensitization in this group too. They collected dust samples to look for the pet allergen levels, but I think that would have been a useful factor to also include in their analysis.
Stan, did any of the patients have both, or was these like exclusive sort of things, or they didn't even get into that? I'm just curious.
I don't think they got into it. They did separate, like they found that statistical, at least for dog ownership when they were older, and they also had a positive IgE. That seemed to have some benefit as well. But
and it wasn't like the quantity, like they didn't say like how many of each animal and stuff like that too, right? Because I've seen that too, like multiple pets and stuff like that. I guess they didn't do that either, right?
No, you know, it's interesting. I didn't notice that. I don't remember seeing anything about the number of cats or the number of dogs in there. They did talk about the amount of can levels in the dog allergen levels in the homes and cat levels in the homes, but they didn't look at dust mite, unfortunately, like Sarah was suggesting. So there's some deficiencies in the study, but again, I'm just a fan of hygiene hypothesis studies, and this is just another one.
Yeah,
absolutely.
just taking a peek at this article, I can't say that the numbers are on the small side. So, for example, again, the number of people who owned a cat early in life who had asthma was like 11 versus 9. And for dog, it was 4, yes, early life, 1, not in early life. And I'm not saying that that's going to move the needle. For both, it was like more, the numbers were more robust, but for cat ownership, the persistence was defined as both early life and school age, I believe. And I can see it was only 13 for asthmatics and 10 for non-asthmatics. So I'm wondering, and again, I can't prove this, could this just be a function of just low N? Once you get like small numbers, these differences get magnified that kind of even out when you get big time N. I think we're waiting for that study. We're waiting for a study that has, I mean, that's what's going to seal the deal. Like big time numbers, like thousands of people, which is going to be really hard to do. So
it's a great point.
Yeah, I think the low numbers, I'm concerned about this study at least. But again, I think ultimately, no matter what I say, people are going to have their pets. So I think if you ask me how many people have rehoused the animal based on the allergy test, I would say very few overall.
It's like your
own kid. It's like your own child. We're not like orphan your own kid, you know, that sort of thing. Okay. All right. So that's a tangent. I apologize. Okay. So let's wrap it up. And I really enjoyed reading this report sponsored by FAIR, Food Allergy Research Education. This was published in Journal of Pediatrics. The title of the article is Awareness and Application of United States Food Allergy Prevention Guidelines Amongst Pediatricians and Other Clinicians, which was the most interesting part of this. That's what I really liked about the study. The other clinicians, I'm going to get to that in a second. So we are all aware that after the LEAP study, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease had the peanut allergy prevention guidelines. We're aware of the three risk groups, no eczema, mild eczema, or moderate severe, and the timing of introduction. And you ask an allergist, we are all in. But guess what? We don't see these babies. We don't see these babies. These babies are seeing generalists. They're not seeing specialists. I mean, they refer to us, they'll still see them. So the front line are generalists. And let me tell you, they're all over the place, right? We're a very small specialty, right? There's way more pediatricians and family physicians. And what this study particularly looks at is advanced practice providers. They are talking about nurse practitioners and physician assistants. And so in addition to pediatricians, family medicines, and APPs, they also included dermatologists who also treat eczema and are clearly going to be asked, is this a food allergy? I mean, they're going to be asked that question. You know they are, right? So the purpose of this study is asking, are they aware of the guidelines? How often do they adhere to the guidelines? And the barriers, because wouldn't you know it, it's not often implemented. So let's talk about this. So they were able to use a third-party company to recruit 250 of each group, pediatricians, family medicine, NPs, PAs, and dermatologists, about 250 of each. And they did an online survey asking a couple things, right? And they got about an 8% response rate. So first question, are you aware of the 27 peanut allergy prevention guidelines? Pediatricians, 76%. Dermatology, 58%. Family medicine, 52%. APPs, 45%, less than half. And interestingly, when they're looking at the distribution, APPs were more likely to work in hospital, community clinic settings, and at the highest level of rural representation, right? So I think there's like an access issue too, where we want certain specialties at the front lines here where some people can't get access of specialty care. And so we rely on certain types of clinicians to provide medical advice. So when they looked further into some of their implementation, they gave the three scenarios right out of the guideline. They presented a infant with no atopic dermatitis or food allergy. They presented a infant who had mild eczema, or a third child with severe eczema or egg allergy, i.e. the high-risk criteria according to the NIAID. And interestingly, when you ask about peanut, would you recommend peanut introduction for the lowest risk group among dermatology, 41% would recommend peanut introduction. APPs, 60%. Family medicine, 54%, lower than APPs, right? Pediatricians, 84%. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. All right. Now, these are ones aware of the guidelines. I'm just choosing the ones aware from the guidelines. All right. Let's go to the high risk group, right? So we're talking about those who have severe atopic dermatitis or egg allergy. Would you recommend some sort of intervention like referral to allergy? Let's say referral to allergy. Pediatricians, 63%. Family medicine, 51%. APP, 68%. Dermatology, 54%. So not bad. How many would say we should do some sort of testing, right? So order peanut-specific IG test. Among pediatricians, it's 16%. And amongst family medicines, it's 20%. So what are some of the other interesting things I've noticed? Is that overall, there was some barriers named for the implementation for the guidelines. And the number one barrier amongst most clinicians was the lack of clinic time, except for APPs. Their number one concern, and this was named by 53% of APPs, was a parental concern of allergic reactions as the major barrier. Other than lack of clinic time and parental concern, other common top-cited barriers would be amongst dermatologists, legal liability, 28%, and then lack of interest by the parent. And I'm not sure if that's perceived interest or real interest. And then 37% of family medicines were concerned about allergic reactions. So not the parent, but the provider. So, I mean, if I wanted to sort of sum up the article, there are certain groups that are at the front lines of seeing these babies who are either not aware of the guidelines or don't give guidance that are aligned with the guidelines. And there are certain barriers that we're going to need to overcome beyond awareness, not just knowing the guidelines, but actually implementing it. And that's really addressing some of these barriers. And then again, I don't have a magic wand, but I attempted to do a quality improvement project in the Atlanta metro area about early introduction and reducing inappropriate food allergy testing. And I heard similar themes regarding this parental concern and clinic time. And so some of the things that I attempted to do was give handouts and information, in fact, pre-reading, so like they could read it ahead of time and then like ask about it in the visit, so you don't have to do all the teaching. But the concern about allergic reactions was a difficult barrier for me to address. And I think when out of my interviews, the number one reason why food allergy testing was done and introduction was delayed was eczema. And I think the core knowledge gap amongst most generalists when I was talking to them is actually most generalists don't know why eczema happens. And the interpretation of eczema as a manifestation of food allergy, like food allergy causing eczema, is a very prevalent belief when I was talking to generalists. And I even met a graduating dermatology resident. I sat down with her and I asked her, could you tell me why eczema happens? And I think she's told me something about T2 inflammation or something like that, which is, I'm not saying it was wrong, but like the core defect of a skin barrier dysfunction, I mean, did not even come up. So even amongst dermatologists, just the core explanation of explaining to parents the intervention of eczema as a skin disease and not principally what you're eating, right? It's more of like skin management is a significant knowledge gap, and we're going to really need to address that knowledge gap if we're going to move the needle. Because the scenario that these generalists are seeing, in my opinion, at least in my experience, is they're coming in and the parent is either worried, so they're worried about risk, so we have to do reassurance about the safety, but also misinterpreting things that they're seeing as food allergy, and therefore has fear or uncertainty, that we need someone confident to explain what is happening, i.e. it's not IgE mediated. And then also, maybe this manifestation increases the urgency for introduction. Actually, the response to this of the presence of eczema is not removal. It's actually introduction to protect the child, which is sort of like a paradigm shift and a different approach, where parents who request testing or come in with testing with eczema, my response to that testing is, okay, well, your child at risk for developing food allergy, this, we have to get into your kid. Like, I want to protect your child. They don't show me that test of like, we better take this out to just make your eczema worse. I'm like, we got to fix the eczema, get the food into your kid, so we fix the eczema and protect your child. So until we get there, we're going to see studies like this. And I think we need sort of national educational efforts to do this. Now, I did present the QI project that I did, and I have to say that it didn't work that great. I would say that I still do work on it. We reduced the percentage of practices doing panel testing for eczema, but the number of tests kind of stayed the same because certain practices are heavy utilizers. So the next phase is to buy them lunch and be a drug rep and talk to them about that. So I'm working on that right now. But anyways, sorry for the long-winded speech, but I just thought it was very interesting. We have APPs, dermatologists, family medicine doctors who have lower awareness than pediatricians. We have to reach out to those groups and equip them to handle these conversations.
Totally agree. You are preaching to the choir. I think this study reaffirms what you're saying, Jerry, and what we're seeing in our practices. And my biggest concern is because of this knowledge gap, it's leading, as you said, to further delays in introduction to these high-risk groups. So I don't think we're going to answer the challenge in this short discussion today, but I think studies like this are valuable in that they're validating our experience and really reinforcing the need for the process improvement, the quality improvement initiatives that you're speaking about.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear that you did that study as part of the college and presented it there. It's very disconcerting to me to see how many advanced practitioners were involved in this study. They're double the number of any of the specialists, or at least generalists, pediatricians, family practitioners, or dermatologists. But and the fact that they had such a low understanding of the guidelines, you know, it really concerns me, because obviously they're swayed by the public. The public wants to put some kind of cause for their kid's eczema. And the cause that the general public thinks is that it's a food. And we need to somehow or another figure out how to switch that paradigm.
So if y'all have an idea on the best way to deliver medical education, maybe you're a secret influencer, or maybe just a master of persuasion or medical education, I would love to get your thoughts. Let's collaborate. You can email me directly at Emory, but also you can email the Allergy Talk email. That's allergytalk@acaai.org. Of course, if you have any feedback or corrections, further thoughts, I'd love to hear from you. And remember, by just listening to this podcast, you can get CME credit. Just go to education.acaai.org/allergytalk. And you can also read archive issues on the same website. That's college.acaai.org/publications/allergywatch. Well, I enjoyed the conversation. I learn every time I do this. Sarah, thank you. Stan, thank you. And y'all, thanks for listening. We'll catch you for the next one. Have a good one. ACAAI is presenting this podcast for educational purposes only. It is not medical advice or intended to replace the judgment of a licensed physician. The college is not responsible for any claims related to the procedures, professionals, products, or methods discussed in the podcast, and it does not approve or endorse any products, professionals, services, or methods that might be referenced.